Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Eric Lane coming to you guys from the Positivity Spartans podcast. We have a very, very special guest today, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. So starting off, fellas, how are you guys doing?
Hey, I'm good. I'm good. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. What about yourself, Marcellus?
Pretty good. Got my normal weekend resting. I had a parade today. That was cool. We went through old tombstone. It's a couple of, maybe 100 or so.
Okay, okay. You were on the horse or just like
Yeah, for B-Troop stuff.
Color guard.
For B-Troop stuff on the horse.
You got to enlighten Dr. Wright on what that
so,
is.
So so I'm active duty military. I'm stationed at Fort Huachuca, Arizona.
Okay.
They have a live cavalry unit. There's only 7 or 8 in the whole military, but we're the only all-volunteer cavalry in the United States Army. Hmm. And so we have, like, active duty, DO dependents and all those type of things, as long as they're DOD associated. Hmm. And we do, like, all types of events throughout the state of Arizona. So today we're not too far from the old school town of Tombstone. You know how they had movies and TV shows about it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're a big tourist attraction. They do a lot of parades. So we do like 3, maybe 4 parades around them every year.
Okay.
Today we did one of
them. Nice. That was good. Now, hey, let me ask you this, Marcellus. Was everybody social distancing?
Mm-hmm. No. Okay. people didn't have masks on and nothing. I was like, okay, well, at least I'm on a horse up here.
Wow.
Away from everybody.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's cool. Dr. Wright, you mind giving your introduction to the people? You know, where you're from, your undergraduate, your master's, PhD, you know.
Okay,
yes, sir.
So I'm Dr. Joshua Wright, native of Washington, D.C. Did my undergraduate study was at Loyola, at the time it was called Loyola College, now it's known as Loyola Maryland University, is the official name for now. Did a master's degree at George Washington University, and then I did my PhD in history at Howard University. I know Eric, me and Eric go back some years. I taught him when he was a freshman at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, Go Hawks. Eric was in my U.S. history intro class, I believe. And, well, I had him in other classes, yep. But that was the first one I had him in. And I think he was in the very first class period that I ever taught at Maryland Eastern Shore. So that was a really big deal for me because it was my first class there. But it was also my first class at a four-year university prior to teaching at Eastern Shore and being in graduate school. I had taught at middle school for a year dealing with fifth through eighth graders, and then I had a short stint at the high school level. And while I was teaching high school, I was doing junior college for military students, actually, since both of you guys are military, this is kind of funny, but I was working with military students at Bethesda Naval Base, and then also Bowling Air Force Base, right?
So, okay.
And I was doing that on pretty much like in the evening after I got finished with work, and then some weekends. So I did that prior to teaching at Maryland Eastern Shore. But yeah, so when I got to Maryland Eastern Shore, that was my first full-time at a four-year university. Did that for a number of years. I left Maryland Eastern Shore, or we'll just say at UMES, because you may hear me bring it up maybe again at some point during the conversation. So UMES for short.
I'm still disappointed in that.
For Trinity Washington University in the summer of 2019. For people who are listening who aren't familiar with Trinity, it is a women's college. It's the alma mater for two people that are polar opposite, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, and then Kellyanne Conway, who used to be affiliated with President Trump. So it's crazy because they are like polar opposites. And Trinity is a very liberal university, so they love, love, love Nancy Pelosi. Once you walk into the main building, you see like a big banner with Miss Pelosi's picture there, right? So they really love her. But Trinity's an interesting school. So like I said, it's an all-women's school. It's changed quite a bit because it went from being a predominantly white school to now we have a very large population of Latina students and also Black students. So it's a lot different from the way it used to be when Miss Pelosi and Miss Conway would have been there. In addition to being at Trinity, so at Trinity I teach in the Global Studies Department, which is a cluster of history, political science, and international affairs. And I teach classes, well, even though my training is in history, they have me teaching some political science, and every now and then I might do something in international affairs. And outside of teaching, I have a podcast of my own. When I say UMES, I started doing a weekly radio show, and I did that for my final year at UMES. And then I left doing media stuff when I first came to Trinity, but now I have a new podcast series, which should be starting late this year, early next year, and it'll be streaming on NPR and then some local platforms. And that's called Woke History. Yeah, Woke History.
Nice.
So it's going to be dealing with historical, but then also contemporary issues pertaining to race, politics, popular culture. You know, and then we bring in, I like to say it's what you don't get in a traditional classroom. And we bring in other scholars like myself. We may have students. We may have civil rights leaders, pastors. But then we also have people involved in media. We have some celebrities that are pretty well known nationally. We have some former athletes who've been on the show. So I'm looking forward to it. And then finally, I'm a writer as well. Had a book a couple of years ago on the TV series Empire, looking at images of Blacks and Empire and just Black images and media in general. I have a new book coming out sometime 2021. I want to say spring 2021, early summer, dealing with Kanye West. I have like some other projects as well that I've done in the past, as well as some other projects that will be coming out next year as well on the writing side. So that's, I know I've been talking way too long, but that's who I am.
Got a lot going on over there. That's nice. So I guess my first question, Doc, would be, at what point in life did you realize you wanted to be a teacher? Like, what sparked your passion for teaching in history?
The first part with the teaching, I'd want to say probably I had a teacher when I was in high school named Mr. Lamoth, and he taught
this book.
Nah, he's a white dude. He's a white dude, believe it or not. That's so funny that you asked that, though, right? Because he's a white dude. But he was just really cool. Like, he's just really, really cool, really passionate about what he did. He was younger. He seemed old to me at the time, but he was probably in his 20s or early 30s, right? But he just made history fun, and I did this class with him on immigration history, and we learned about the different immigrant groups that came to America and their experiences. And also within that class, he focused on African Americans, because even though, you know, you think African Americans is not really an immigrant group, they still have a very interesting story. And he introduced us to the Eyes on the Prize documentary series from PBS, which breaks down the civil rights movement from the 50s through the early part of the 1980s. And that was my first time ever seeing that and learning about anything other than, I mean, when I went to Black schools growing up until I got to high school. So, you know, we would have the Black history reports every year. So we definitely learned about people other than Rosa Parks, Dr. King, Frederick Douglass, Malcolm X. You know, we learned about Ralph Bunche, and we learned about some other people that, you know, aren't the typical folks that everybody can name. But even still, I didn't really know that much about the civil rights movement and what was going on. So that really got the ball rolling. And then my dad, he really loves history. He's not a historian, but he's someone who really loves history, loves learning, loves politics. And he would encourage me to read books and watch documentaries and watch the news. And that's really where that passion got started. In terms of teaching, I can't really pinpoint one specific moment, but I would say my dad taught. He was a retired pastor now, but he taught at the college level for a little bit. He taught at North Carolina State University and then at Howard University for a little bit in the Divinity School. So he taught, and then my grandmother taught for 20-plus years at the primary level and middle school level. And my granddad mostly worked with the post office, but he was also in education as well. And he taught and was an administrator. And then both my grandparents on my mom's side, they coached a little bit. So I think that it was always in my blood, you know, to be involved in education in some form or fashion. So, yeah, I think that's how they got started.
So, as far as education, what would you say is some of your favorite things about being an educator?
I think so. Number one, being able to see your students grow. And I'm going to use Eric since he's on the call with us right now. But I just remember him coming in being this bright-eyed, bushy-tailed freshman, 18 years old, out of PG County, wet behind the ears, and we would have a lot of conversations about classes, how to study, but then we would have other, you know, conversations about things he was dealing with ROTC, things he was dealing with back at home, career choices he wanted to make, and just being able to see how he grew from that young 18-year-old to being a grown man now with a job, a wife, a child, seeing, you know, he's graduated from college, seeing the different things that he's doing, that motivates me because it shows that I can have a positive impact on somebody's life. And it's cool for them to, like, learn what you're teaching. Obviously, you know, as a professor or any teacher at any level, you want the students to learn what, you know, they're coming to your class for. But I think it's also good when you make that connection and you're able to not just impact what they learn for those 8 to 16 weeks, but you're able to impact the rest of their lives and the type of men and women they go on to become. And then the fact that he's a young African-American makes it even sweeter, you know, because I'm helping somebody who was in the same position that I may have been in some years ago.
Like give back power.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Paying it forward. Yeah, that's something I can definitely say. Your approach as a professor is a lot different compared to other professors. Obviously, I think you were, 32% of UMS?
Yeah, like
31?
Yeah.
Okay, you were 30, so you were relatively young. So a lot of students, we could relate, and we felt comfortable coming to you because, you know, you were very approachable. So that's something that I truly admire and something that I try to emulate within my leadership now within the military. I just try to be very open-minded and approachable. You know, definitely I try to be calm like you as well because you're very calm and poised even when you disagree with people. I can, my co-host will definitely tell you, when I disagree with people sometimes, I can get a little hot-headed, but that's something I truly admire. That's something I truly admire and try to emulate from you. So I truly appreciate you and, I have a lot of respect for you, and I know you may not speak with a lot of students from UMES, but they speak highly of you as well, Doc. A lot of us were really upset when we found out that you had parted ways with UMES, man. We had envisioned you potentially being a future president of the university.
Well, I mean, it's humbling to hear that, and I mean, I definitely love the UMES. I definitely love it. I miss it too, from time to time. I think about it, and I think about the experiences I have. I find myself a lot of times, because I've only been at Trinity for not even a full year and a half, and then last year really got disrupted because of what happened with the pandemic in March. So even though it's been a year and a half, in some ways it's almost been like a year because of the time we lost with the pandemic. But yeah, from time to time, so I find myself comparing how we did things there to how we do things here. And I have to remind myself, hey, it's a whole new place now. You can't do that.
It's totally different. We don't do that here.
Right. You know, it's a totally different totally different type of environment. But I definitely say I love you. Yes. Well, I haven't had a chance to talk with a lot of the students since I've left. I still have talked with some of my coworkers just to, you know, stay abreast in terms of what's happening. So, yeah. But UMass, I mean, I was there so long that I feel like that's always going to be a part of my story. You know, like when you spend that much time in any one place, that really becomes a chapter in your life. That's not just a footnote or a couple of pages. That really is a chapter. If I was an artist, it would be an album for me. You know what I mean? Or a series of albums that I put out, because it really was pivotal to me growing as an instructor, as a writer, as a man, as a person, all of those different things.
Do you feel like transitioning from a public university to a private institution, like you feel like there's less you can do or less involvement that you have with the students? Like, are there more rules or more restrictions?
No, I mean, I haven't really faced that so far. I thought that might have been the case, especially coming to a private institution and a Catholic Catholic women's school, excuse me. Yeah, I mean, those were some things that I was wondering about coming in. But no, I'm gonna say that I haven't had to deal with that too much.
So what would you say would be some of your challenges as an educator? Like, are there some students that you feel like, oh, I don't think I'm ever going to get through to them, or... Yeah, what do you do for your breakthroughs?
Yeah, I think we all, when I say we, you know, as educators, I think we all probably come across students who may be a little more challenging than others. And like anything in life, you're never going to be able to impact everybody. And I know, like, we come in and we say we want to touch everybody. But the truth of the matter is, there will be, you know, in a lot of cases, I mean, there will be some people that you just won't be able to reach for different reasons. Now, as an educator, you have to find ways to reach them no matter what, like whether that's spending more time with that particular student, maybe that's changing up your methods of teaching a little bit. I mean, you can't just give up, but at the same time, you have to realize that, you know, everybody's coming to your class from a different place in their life, and you don't always know what people have going on outside of your classroom, and that sometimes, you know, gets in the way of them really shining as you would like to see them shine. And then, you know, I mean, I just speak from my own experience, right? Some people just won't like you. You know what I mean? Like, they may not like the subject you're teaching. You know, they may not like the subject, or they just may not like you. They may not like the sound of your voice. They may not like how you look. They may not like the way you dress, how you walk. They may not like, I mean, it's a million things that, you know, may make someone gravitate towards you, but then it could also turn somebody off, you know, and that's just how it is, you know what I mean? It's like, and I, you know, and again, I make a lot because I deal with popular culture a lot in my research. I may make comparisons throughout our conversation to sports or to music or TV, you know, but there are artists that they just don't do like it for stuff. Me. You know, they don't do it for me, but then somebody else, that's their man, you know, that's their girl, right? But that artist has to do it for me. That doesn't mean they're not a good artist. That doesn't mean that they don't have a good body of work or music or a good message. But for whatever reason, I'm just not in the position to really receive it. You know what I mean?
Like Cameron.
Yeah, I mean, some people love Cameron, some people don't. You know, but I mean, like, but truthfully, though, I mean, it really is that way sometimes with teaching. So you can't take it personal. All you could do is just really try your best to break through. Now, the beauty is when you get a student who was, you know, struggling or who wasn't feeling you for whatever reason early on, and then you do finally get that breakthrough, and you see, wow, that student turned it around from an F to a C or from a C to a B or an A, or they couldn't stand you in the beginning, and you didn't think you could stand them either. But by the end of the semester, y'all ended up actually liking each other. Maybe that student takes you again in the future, and maybe they don't, but they still, you know, they respect you, and maybe they ask you for recommendation letters, and you know what I mean? So,
yeah. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. I think that's unique. I guess you can say us being a leader in the military and being NCOs, it's kind of synonymous and equivalent to you guys being a teacher, because a lot of times we'll get these soldiers fresh out of high school, 17, 18 years old. It's pretty much our job to, you know, like bring them up to speed with military traditions, military culture, military standards. But we also have to ensure that they understand like the basic fundamentals of being a human being, such as finances, sometimes credit, So it is a blessing and a great thing to see them grow up through the ranks and their matriculation from, you know, private all the way up to an NCO or whichever direction they desire to go in. So we can definitely relate
yeah.
to
yeah,
to,
and to what you know, you're like saying. I learned from my students. I'm there to teach them, but I learn things from them. You know, mm-hmm. Things that they may make mm-hmm. me see something from a different perspective or a different point of view that I never would have thought of. Just because sometimes it's because of the age difference. Sometimes it's because their experience in life might be different from mine, so they may come at something totally different. You know what I mean? With a fresh set of eyes. And that improves me as a teacher because it makes me see things, you know, from a whole new perspective, you know. So I think that's really important. And then another thing I think has always helped me is mentorship. I try to mentor my students. So when I was working with Eric, I try to be a mentor to mm-hmm. him. I try to be a mentor to Damien and some of the other people from UMES that I work with that Eric knows, right? But, you know, I also would turn to other professors. Usually people who are older than me, sometimes they might have been in the same age group, but usually folks who are older than me, and I would look to them for mentorship too, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think no matter how old you are, unless you're like really old, you know, like, you know, you never stop learning.
Dr. Mosley.
You never stop learning. So there was a professor, you mentioned Dr. Mosley. He was an older professor at UMES, but then there was another gentleman named Dr. Austin, who was in my department, and I used to bug Dr. Austin all mm-hmm. the time because he had decades of experience, you know? Mm-hmm. So I would go to him and ask him for advice on a number of things, and I would ask my department chair for advice, and I still stay in touch with some of my old professors from graduate school, and I have mentors from church and family members and different people that I'll turn to for advice, because I definitely know I definitely don't know it all, and I'm always learning, and I know that you could always improve, and no matter what you're doing and what area it is. So I think mentorship's important for everybody, you know, in terms of helping you make professional moves, personal moves, financial moves. You know, you can never stop learning.
What are some of how has it been teaching during the pandemic? You know, explain like the struggles or the pros and the cons.
Yeah, so I'm gonna just
think that you would like to see differently going
for
forward.
The listeners, again, everybody's experience is different. So what I'm saying is coming more from my experience. So this really applies to me, and it may apply to some professors at my university, but it can look totally different if you're talking to a professor at a different school. And I'll explain what I mean in a few seconds, but when the pandemic started, just like everybody, it caught us off guard. It caught me off guard. They told us we were on spring break right when things started closing. And we thought it was just going to be a quick turnaround where, okay, we'll... So at first what they told us is you have the option to come on class or you could do classes online. And at the time, people weren't talking about Zoom like that. So we had something, I think it was Google Meet that we were going to use. And it was supposed to just be temporary for a couple of weeks, but then it got extended to a month. And then soon after, things really just kept changing week to week. And soon after it became, hey, this is probably going to be how it's going to be for the next 3 months or 2 to 3 months, right? Until the semester ends. Mm-hmm. And it was an adjustment. Luckily, it happened at a good time, only because we had already had half of the semester out of the way. We'd had midterms, and then right after midterms, we went to spring break, and then we came back. So I had a chance to get to know my students already for the first half of the semester. So when we made that switch, it wasn't as difficult because mm-hmm. I had already established somewhat of a relationship with them, right? And then also we were at a point of the year where we had end of the semester research projects that were going to be coming up. So, you know, the students were already going to be spending time with their projects. So things really weren't that bad for me. One of the things that I was doing, I was going to have some field trips and those got canceled. And then we were going to have some guest speakers come into class.
And luckily, I was able to get them to join us via, you know, virtual space. So that was okay because, we didn't lose out on having those people, right? And in some ways, it almost benefited me because we didn't have to worry about providing any type of travel
transportation,
expense, right? You know, payment, because it's like, hey, just hop on and meet us. And let me just say this one thing. So there was I had a pretty big guest in one of my classes, and I'm not going to name names, but she did it for free. Somebody in politics, and it was a good class. It was a really great class to have her. And I was kind of feeling myself a little bit. So I said, hey, I'm dealing with this issue in one of my other classes, and I want to reach out to this person to see if they'll do the class for me. And me thinking, well, hey, this last person did it free of charge, gave me an hour. Hey, I'm just asking you to do my class for 20 minutes. And they asked me for something crazy, like in terms of price. You know, they wanted to charge me, they literally wanted to charge me, I think I heard you say 300, and it was actually more than that, right?
Oh my goodness, for 20 minutes?
To do a 20-minute Zoom, and I'll tell you guys who it is off air. I don't want to put the person on blast, because it is somebody who's kind of big, and a lot of people respect this person, but yeah, it was like, wow, really? For like 20 minutes, you're FaceTiming me, and my class for 20 minutes. You know what I mean? And you're charging me money for a FaceTime call. But moving forward, so once we figured out that, it's crazy, right? Once we figured out the next school year was going to be like this, one of the things they really had us doing at Trinity was to make sure that everybody was properly prepared for this new online format. Because it was so sudden that all we really had was maybe, like a couple of 1 hour, 2 hour sessions, and then it just started really fast in the spring. But in the summertime, they wanted to make sure that everybody was really adjusted for this. So we had to go through an intense training session where we did two seminars. They're about 2 or 3 hours each initially in June, but then in July, we had to do a full month-long course where we really had to spend, I want to say it was an equivalent of maybe a total of 20 hours, over that time period. And we were in there, we had lessons, we had homework we had to do, we had to submit things. Like, I actually felt like a student all over again. And I kind of felt that way in a really long time, where I had to do an assignment for a grade and get it turned in by a certain deadline. So that actually made me somewhat sympathetic to my students, just because I forgot what that felt like when you're juggling a whole bunch of different tasks. Right. Yeah. You know what I mean? I wish I did.
I wish you felt that way back in the day, though.
Maybe more aware, you know what I mean? So, but it was helpful. It was really helpful, because what they showed us was that to do an online class, there's certain things that you have to do that are different from a traditional classroom setting. And even when I was at Maryland and I was teaching online classes, we never really had that training to that level. So now, certain things I wasn't doing right back then, I understand why, certain things weren't working. So it was really helpful for me, and it got me prepared for this upcoming school year. So right now, I'm doing four classes. I have three hybrid classes, which means that it's half face-to-face in person on campus and then half online. And then I have one class which is fully online. So with the classes fully online, it's fully online, but we meet regularly each week online on Zoom. So it's not – and I've had classes online in the past where I didn't meet my students really at all during the semester, unless they lived, on campus and they came by to my office and I met them. Or maybe at the end of the semester, we would do a research presentation and I would see everybody then, or we might have some study sessions. But that was it. And with those classes, I never really liked them, because I didn't get to engage with the students the way I could in a traditional classroom. So there were a lot of times where I didn't know the students. Like, I honestly did, I just didn't know mm-hmm. them that well. But with this new live stream environment on Zoom, I see these students online every week. We get to actually, you know, exchange with each other. The students mm-hmm. interact with each other. We do breakout rooms. So it's just like a real classroom, but it's just virtual. With the hybrid classes, again, it's half and half. That's interesting because we can only have so many people in the class at once. So I had to break up the class into halves where I'm meeting with one half, wow. you know, one day out of the week, and then I meet with the other half of the class the other day of the week. But then even on those days, I may have half of the students in the room and the other half of the students on live stream because we gave the students the option that, hey, if you're not comfortable being in the classroom, you could just live stream it. You know, like mm-hmm. if you're coming from home and you don't want to risk getting sick because you live with your parents, you live with older people, you know, a lot of the students may have to take public transportation to campus. You know, we're just like, okay, you could live stream the class. So that's interesting because you're having to teach to people sitting in the room, but then you're also having to look at the computer and talk to them. And then it's like, if I'm doing something in the classroom, I got to make sure that I remember to share my screen and share my sound so that mm-hmm. the people on Zoom can hear it. And then the Zoom people, they could hear me because I'm right in front of the mic. But in like conversations in the classroom, they can't always hear because the sound doesn't always pick up on the mic. So it's like, I have to repeat what the students are saying in the class to the people on the computer. So that's a little bit of a challenge, and it took me, I'm not gonna lie, it took me a few weeks to kind of get used to the whole back and forth. But it's coming. I think like we're at midterms now actually, so it's finally coming where I feel comfortable now with doing that. So yeah. And you know, and I was talking with some of my other colleagues too, because I was thinking about this, preparing for this conversation. And I think what we all experience is with the online learning. So it's like being in the NBA bubble. For people who follow basketball, if you watch the bubble, if you watch the NBA playoffs, you know, there were pluses and minuses with that bubble. So the plus with the bubble experience was that the players, they didn't have to travel. So they were rested. They didn't have to deal with going away to play in different arenas. So in some ways it was good, but then, and then also you had games back to back to back to back. So we always had a lot of games, right? But then the bad part with the bubble is it takes away that real life experience of interacting with the fans, you know, in the arenas, right? And it's the same thing when you're teaching.
Like you're being like deprived.
In a hybrid class, at least I get to be around my students for half the week, right? But again, because not everybody's coming to campus, and then with the online class, there's still, it's different because I'm engaging with you and I'm seeing you, but I'm still not face to face with you in the classroom. And even when we do breakout rooms, you know, I could eavesdrop on the students from time to time to hear what people are saying, but I can't just easily walk around the room to see what people are talking about, to see what people are doing. And then also
answer questions.
Answer questions. You know, sometimes when students get online, it's easy for them to hide behind the camera, much easier than it would be in a face-to-face. Because I could look at you and I could tell if you aren't paying attention. Or if you look like you're confused, or if you look like you're lost. And when people are online, number one, sometimes people don't turn their cameras on, right? So if you turn mm-hmm. your camera off, then I can't see you. I don't know if you're actually paying attention to me or if you're doing something else, right? And, you know, that makes a huge difference, you know? And then if you, you know, if you're doing something else, you're not looking at me, you might be missing some things. So, yeah, this, it's just that personal interaction that you're losing out on that makes things different. So yeah, and also, but this, and this is the point I was making earlier where I said my experience is unique because Trinity's a smaller school, So at a large school, they're going to have an entirely different perspective on this than I would. If I was teaching at Maryland College Park, University of Texas, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Alabama, those really huge schools with 30, 40,000 students, and you're in a classroom with 50 to 100 kids, you know, young adults, et cetera, that's different. So it's easier for me to interact with students online in a smaller class if I have 30 people compared to if I have 100 people on Zoom. I can't really interact with everybody on a week-to-week basis, you know what I mean? So that really changes the dynamic a lot. So that's why I say my experience is different. And then also, I'm a younger person. I'm not as young as you guys, where I'm, you know, just always on social media and different things of that nature. But I'm young enough to the point where I'm doing technology a lot. Whereas, you know, some older professors who've been teaching who might be in their 60s, you know, 70s, it's very challenging for them to try to deal with the technology. So, yeah.
So, Dr. Wright, where'd you grow up again?
I'm from the DMV. So that's for listeners, I don't know where people are from. DMV means DC, Maryland, Northern Virginia, that area. Spent a couple of years in South Carolina because I have family from there. But for most of my life, it's been Prince George's County, Montgomery County, Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland, Washington, D.C., primarily moving around. And then the Eastern Shore, obviously, you know, primarily in those areas.
Okay. So myself, Isaiah, and Eric, we talk about this. And we kind of ask, I guess, sometimes when we bring in the topic of school. How many Black teachers did you grow up with?
So my early experience, I really can't speak that well to pre-K. Pre-K to me is a blur. I remember it, but I don't remember it all that well. So I'm going to start when I got to kindergarten. And K through eighth grade, the school I went to, most of the students were Black. With the teachers, I would say it was half and half. But I would also say most of my teachers, when I say half and half, I mean white and Black. We didn't have Latinx or Asian or, you know, other. But most of the teachers would have been women, though. Like, I don't remember having too many, through eighth grade, I didn't have too many male teachers unless they were physical education, right? Mm. And then when I went to high school, the school I attended, it was an all-boy Catholic school. The majority of teachers there would have been male just because of that setting. We did have women teachers, but most of them were male. Most of them were white. I'm trying to think about how many Black teachers I had in high school. High school, we had some Black guidance counselors. Obviously, sports was really big in my high school. So a lot of the coaches, I'll take that back. A lot of the coaches were white. My track coach was Black. A lot of the assistant coaches, I think, were Black. But a lot of the head coaches were probably white there, too. So, yeah, it was a lot of white teachers at the high school level. And then at college, I had one male Black teacher, I think my whole 4 years, because I was at a PWI. So my whole 4 years, I had one male Black teacher my freshman year. And then I think I had one or two Black women teachers, and everybody else was white. Now, we had Black people we work with who were counselors and Black people who were over, you know, like certain student service things of that nature. But most of them were white. You know, when I got to Howard, I think everybody almost at Howard was Black. For the most part. I had a white teacher at Howard. I had one or two white teachers at Howard, if I remember correctly. But most of them definitely would have been Black. And I had a lot of Black male teachers at Howard, which was great. Why you guys ask that question?
So I just want to ask, just to see like what impact did that have on you as a African-American male? Like, do you feel you related more to those teachers or
the Black teachers?
Was it easier to learn from them, or
honestly,
it just made
you know what? So here's the thing, right? And I like, we have that conversation a lot about, you know, having black teachers, black role models, people you can relate to and look up to. For me, I don't think it made that huge of a difference only because I was accustomed to white teachers. I was accustomed to having white teachers from growing up. Like, I didn't have a lot of black teachers. Like I said, I have black women's teachers. So because I had the white women and the black women, I mean, I don't think I looked at it in middle school and elementary. I don't think I looked at either one any different. I don't think that I had this black teacher named Miss Lucas, right? Who was, I think she's like my eighth grade teacher. She was black. She was from, I don't remember where she was from. I just remember she was black. She had a jerry curl. And she was cool, but she ain't play, right? Like, she would punch you in the chest if she felt like you weren't acting right. And teachers aren't supposed to punch you in the chest. So, you might have to edit that out of the conversation. But he would punch you in the chest, and we didn't think nothing of it because we were just like, I guess that's just how it is. But my point is, like, I won't say I learned more from her than I learned from my white teacher, because I didn't really look at things that way, right, at that time period. And when I went to high school, prestigious white high school or whatever. So, you know, like, it was just that whole, I don't know, like, I mean, if I was the only black kid in my class, I had a few classes where I was in AP or honors, and it might have just been me and one or two other black kids. And I definitely did notice the difference having all these white kids in the class and having a white teacher. But because there was no black teacher that I could look to, it wasn't like, I was like, oh, yes, you know, you are my, you know, my hero. It wasn't that. I was just like, hey, I'm at this school. This is what it is. And I got to, I got to make it. But again, I was coming from a background where I had people in my life who were male, you know, and female, who were college educated at home, in my family, people at church. So I was always around black role models on a regular basis, because I know some people aren't as fortunate and they don't have that. But for me, because I had that, being at those, you know, environments where there weren't a lot of black teachers, it didn't bother me all of that much, because I was just like, hey, it is what it is. And, you know, that's how it is. But like I said, by the time I got to Howard, that was one of the things that I did enjoy. Excuse me, was having somebody who looked like me, or looked like my mom, or looked like my dad, or who could speak my language, or, you know what I mean, having somebody I could relate to. And Howard was my most favorable learning experience.
Institution.
Right, and I think it was partly because of that. And I know even at where I'm teaching now, you know, that they told us that, in not so many words, that they hired me and, you know, some other people who started with me because they thought we could relate to their changing student body. You know, that we could relate to those young black women and you know, Latina women who were at that school more so than some of these older white women who had been previously teaching them before we got there. So can I make a point earlier, Doc? Because there was one thing we were touching on and I forgot to mention this when we were talking about teaching in the pandemic. Another thing that I think is a pro is in the online environment, you can pretty much teach people anywhere, anytime, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because you don't have to rely on that physical setting, that changes the game completely. I have a student who's in one of my classes now who's in Botswana, which is located in Africa, and she's 6 hours ahead of us. And I didn't even know that until maybe the third week of class. Which is like, hey, I'm sorry for being late, but I'm here in Africa, and it's a 6-hour time difference. And then, like, last week, she missed class. We were supposed to do a debate, and she was one of my debaters. And I ended up having to cancel class completely because she told me an hour before that, hey, in my village, the electricity is out.
Oh, man.
So we won't have internet, and I don't know when it's coming back. You know what I mean? So it's like, well, you can't really do anything about that, right?
Yeah.
No, you really can't. So the point I'm trying to make is you can have class anywhere, regardless of where people are. When I started out teaching at the military, I had a student who got shipped out to Iraq, right? He started the class with me, and then he got shipped out halfway through. But he stayed with it and was doing homework online. But it was different back then. So I would just have to email him stuff, and then he would email it back to me. Whereas now you could go on Blackboard or you could go on whatever platform you're using and just do the work there. And now with the live stream, you know, as long as you have internet access, you can live stream me from anywhere in the planet. So that's a benefit. But then the downside is, again, if you have a student like the one I just mentioned in Africa, where your village loses electricity, then the student is at a disadvantage, right? Or students who come from poor backgrounds where they don't have internet access, or if you're from a family and you have to share the computer or the internet with a whole bunch of siblings and everybody's doing their homework at once, then it may make it harder for that student to do class, like, you know what I mean, like they need to. So that's a drawback to this whole online learning environment from a college standpoint.
So at all levels, right?
Yeah, well, pretty much. I wasn't at the primary level, but I started out, like I said, with the fifth through the eighth grade. That just wasn't for me. I felt as though I was babysitting a lot of times. And I was out there with some lesson plan. And some of it was me too, I was new and also just not having a lot of teaching strategies as well. But you know, I would come in with a lesson plan. I'm like, hey, boys and girls, we're gonna learn this. And they're just like, we wanna play and we wanna fight. And you know, that wasn't a good fit for me. I'm glad I did it because it toughened me up, because I was teaching, my first experience was I was doing middle school in Southeast DC, and I came in with a lot of new teachers, and all of them, with the exception of me, either quit or got fired. And I was the only one who made it through the whole year. And it toughened me up a lot, because there were a lot of days I would go home and I would want to cry because I was just, it was hard. I'm not going to lie, it was so hard. So but it toughened me up quite a bit. And then when I moved up to the next level, which was high school worked out for me better. I enjoyed it, but I knew I didn't want to stay teaching high school. If I stayed at the high school level, I probably would have eventually gone into administration and, you know, been trying to be a vice principal or something, a principal, whatever.
And then you're not a teacher anymore.
Right. You know, so, but the high school was cool. Learned there too. Learned from working with those students. And when, you know, then did the junior college on the side. And then finally got to the four-year level. And I think that working at the lower levels was great preparation for me, because a lot of college professors unless they're education majors, they aren't properly trained in terms of teaching methodology and how to actually teach. So they know their subject matter really, really well, but they don't actually know how to teach it. So unless you have been trained in teaching, or unless you're just a natural gifted public speaker and you just know how to really like engage audiences and things of that nature, it can sometimes be challenging for you. And then depending on what type of discipline and subject you're teaching, it could even be more challenging, right? So working with, you know, the lower levels showed me a lot of different things about how you have to teach, you know. And I'm not saying that just because I taught at a high school or taught at middle school that made me some excellent teacher, because again, there were still things that I needed to learn. And even to this day, it's still new strategies and things that I'm learning and things that I'm trying to get better at. Because naturally for me, I'm a natural introvert, right? I'm not somebody who just walks into the room and I'm the center of attention or I get the party started. That's not my personality. But when I'm in a classroom, I always have to step out of my comfort zone. And that's the funny thing. I do a lot of things that are not in my comfort zone at all. Like, I'm on a dance team, which people always find to be funny. Yeah, people always find that to be funny because I don't dance.
Oh, yeah, at the church. Rhythm. You did tell me that,
like,
one.
I don't have any of that, right? And I got talked into dancing with the men at my church for one Sunday, and I thought it was just going to be a one-time thing. because I was cool with the dudes. Right, and then they got me, right? They got me, and it was just like, well, we don't have that many people. Why don't you just do it? And now it's like 2-3 years into it. Now I'm like really on the dance team, and it's like, and it's funny because when it's the men dancing, it's just us, right? And some dudes are better than others, and it's like guys of all ages, like college kids up to people in their like 50s, I think, or whatever, right? So and we got little kids. I take that back. We got one guy has his son who's a little boy, and another guy has his son who's in high school. So it really is all ages, which is cool. But when it's just the guys, it's just the guys, right? Now, with this whole pandemic thing, what our coach has us doing is she's making videos of all the dance teams dancing together, right? So that they could post those online for the church. So now we're coming out there, and it's not just us guys. Now we're out there with the real, like, the ladies who really dance. Like, who really dance.
Doing it.
Right. And it's like, I'm not on y'all level whatsoever. You know what I mean? But, again, I'm just like, it's good, though, because you step out of your comfort zone. So stepping out of your comfort zone, that helps me. The dancing, doing that. Even playing sports growing up, because I wasn't a natural athlete, but I played sports. I ran track. I tried out for basketball. I did it. But when I really tried out for the varsity level, I was never good enough to play at that level. But, you know, still just doing things like that helps me because it's just like you can't be afraid. If you want to accomplish things in life, you got to be able to step out of your comfort zone if you want to get good and accomplish anything. And, I take that into the classroom. Like, I'm introverted, but when I'm in a classroom, I got to speak. And I got to speak a lot. And I gotta be funny, even if I'm not funny. I gotta try to be funny, and I gotta try to be entertaining. And I gotta talk to folks. And sometimes, sometimes I gotta battle people a little bit. I mean, again, I think part of the reason why I probably am so chill and laid back and have a calm demeanor is, because I'm an introvert. I don't have to be like, oh, well, it's all about me, and I'm gonna get in your face if I disagree with you. Even though I can do that at times, depending on the situation. And even doing interviews like this, doing the podcast I do. When I wrote my book, I got to go on TV. The first book, I got to go on TV, and I got to do different interviews, and I got to speak on panels at conferences. And all of that, again, is stepping out of my comfort zone, though, but... I think a lot of people do that because I've been studying up on various entertainers, and I know a lot of entertainers, Michael Jackson is one of them, are really shy people. But when they get on stage, when they're doing their thing, that's when they come alive. You're right, they're in their zone. That's when they really come alive. But then once they get off that stage, it's like quiet again. I'm good just being with myself, and I don't have to be around a whole bunch of people, so
You have a very innovative style of learning. So my sellers, let me tell you what Dr. Wright is in college, man. So every starter, he wouldn't make any student buy the book. That's one thing I can say I appreciate. He always okay. We'll cut that out. I got you. So he would give us a 15 to 20 page reading every night. And then the following day in class, we would have a quiz on it. Right? So at the end of the semester, we would have an exam. We had two exams, a midterm and a final exam. On the midterm exam, it would pretty much be one question would be a verbal question. So you had to go in there and present everything verbally. And then the other four questions would be any of the previous quizzes he can give you. You would have to write pretty much like two pages, like physically handwrite two pages, like like in class. So obviously the max you can get for each question would be 20 points. And then at the end of the semester, he would do the same thing. Your verbal question would be your choice. It can be any question from the quiz that you had throughout the semester. But Man, it's about like 16, like 16 weeks so in funny, a semester almost. Like, can you imagine how many quizzes so we had and how many questions we had to study, bro?
And some of it I don't, and obviously this comes back to this whole idea of, you know, you grow and you change over time. So I do still make the students write a lot. I know, not last semester, but the fall, because last semester we weren't physically in the class because of COVID, but in the fall semester, yeah, we would have a midterm that would be scheduled for 75, 80 minutes, right? Where the 80 minutes would be up and we would have to literally get up and move to an empty classroom because people weren't done yet. People had to keep going. So the midterm might end up taking some students 2 hours to complete, you know? Yeah, so I definitely still make them write a lot. The oral part I don't do anymore. I haven't done that in a really long time. I think I did that for maybe my first 2 or 3 years where I would do the oral question. And where I got that from was my own experience in graduate school where you do oral exams. And they literally test you like that where you have to come in and they give you a question and you have to stand there and you have to defend it. Now, for you guys, I don't think it was that bad where I think maybe y'all have 5 or 10 minutes, but at the graduate level, you have a question, you literally have to stand there and you have to do an oral defense, which may take 30 minutes or more. You know, so that's where I got that from. But yeah, I stopped doing that, but we definitely still write a lot. I noticed this semester I have some tests where there's some fill-in-the-blank questions and some multiple-choice questions, and I've never done that. I've never, ever done that. And that's partly because of – no, you know what? I think part of that is because of the online
– he's taking it easy now,
right,
man.
Where everything's online, so some of it's just me mixing it up a little bit. And then some of it also is me seeing that you can grade stuff just a little bit faster. If you don't have 20 essays per student to grade, you can really save a little bit of time.
Oh, my personal life.
Some of it is that, right? You know, work smarter, work a little harder. But work smarter, not harder. You know, so some of it is that. But I do have a class. I do one of my classes. We'll have an exam this week where they have. Wow, their test is somewhat hard because they have five essays that you got to do 4 of the 5. And it's like a constitutional law type class, though. So you got to analyze a Supreme Court case. And yeah, you got to write out like a page breaking down the Supreme Court case and the facts of the case and the decisions of who voted for the majority opinion and who voted against the pen. I don't feel good for them at all.
But that's like, you know, 50 to 100 pages to read, so just to write a page about it, I don't think that's asking too much,
man. It was a struggle, bro. I'm not even gonna lie, like, it was a struggle. It was definitely a struggle, but I appreciate that because, Marcella, as you know, in our current jobs, like, everything we do now is verbally. Like, we do oral presentations with certain times, training, briefings, you know, command slides, so forth and so on. So I can definitely say that class has prepped me with my public speaking skills. So, yeah, it was just funny to ponder on that. So, Dr. Wright, let's transition into the voting thing. Not trying to get too political, but what are your sentiments when it comes to voting? Because I know a lot of Black people within our generation, they say, voting doesn't matter. My vote won't serve any purpose. So, you know, though, just how do you feel overall? And, like, you know, what's the history?
Go to about 8:30. So I have a little more time to get into this topic if y'all want to. But yeah, with the voting. Yeah, I've thought a lot about this. I knew we were going to get into this part of the conversation, so I've definitely been thinking a lot about this over the weekend. And it's so important. It's so important. As I've been thinking about it, you know, I've really thought, I mean, just like the significance of it. So, and I bring this up because I remember with the last election, Colin Kaepernick came into some hot water because he didn't vote. And he made it public that he didn't vote for, and he didn't vote at all. And Stephen A. Smith, the host on ESPN's First Take, just totally condemned him and said, hey, I can't take anything you say seriously if you're not going to vote, right? Now, I disagree with that to some extent, but I also understand Stephen A.'s sentiment. So where I disagree on that is Colin is and has been doing the work. You know, he has his Know Your Rights camp that he does for kids in Oakland. He obviously sacrificed 3 years of his career. He's out there, you know, he may not speak as much, you know, as we like him to or as some public figures do, but Colin is doing the work. So I'm never going to just totally discount somebody if they don't vote, because I know a lot of people who go out and they cast their ballot every 4 years or every 2 years, and that's all they do for that 2 or 4 years, and they do nothing else. So I'm not going to just say that because I voted, then that makes me better than you who's really out there sacrificing and doing the work, right? I want to make that very clear. At the same token, and I understand where Colin feels as though, well, I'm just voting for a system that has been oppressing me for generations, and I'm just voting for the lesser of two evils. So I get all of that when he makes that argument, and I understand when young people will say that as well, like, why am I voting? Things aren't going to change. Now, this is where I agree with Stephen A., and I'll push back in terms of saying that, no, you need to vote. You know, you need to take it seriously. Number one, people need to vote because when you vote for a president, when you go into an election and you place your ballot, you're not only voting for the president, right? You're voting for other people on that ticket, right? And then also we have what are called midterm elections every 2 years where you vote for members of Congress. We have local elections where you get to vote for city councilmen, mayors, governors. You get to vote for people who are over the school board. You get to vote for sheriffs. You also get to vote for, and I noticed this on the ballot because I voted already for this upcoming election and submitted everything this past Friday. I know that you vote for judges too. You know, you get to vote for your judges. So it's not just the president. There's checks and balances. There's an executive branch, which is your president, your legislative, which is your Congress, the people who make the laws, your judicial branch, which are the judges. And when we say judges, it's not just the Supreme Court, but it's the district judge, which is the lowest level. It's the appellate judge, which is if you lose your case, then you could do an appeal. And then after that, you get to the state Supreme Court. And if it's a federal case, you go to the federal Supreme Court, right? And then you also have, you know, judges for, you know, divorce and, you know, civil lawsuits and things of that nature, right? But the point I'm trying to make is you're voting for all of these different positions, right? So the president can only do but so much. But it's the people at all of those other parts of government, of Congress, the people at the state and the city level who really are making things go. So if you don't like the fact that, you know, the people overseeing the police department in your city, you know, aren't doing things that are helping minorities, right? You could change that by actually voting them out, right? You could change that by running yourself. You could run for office yourself. You know, and then there are different things on the ballot. Like, they have questions like, do you want this money going here? Do you want this in your community, right? It's all types of questions that people are voting on, too. And if you don't vote for any of that, then none of the changes you want to see happen will ever take place. Now, the system's not perfect. It's not perfect, right? Because with the election for president, we have the popular vote. And then we have the Electoral College. So even
how do you feel about that?
Even if, you know, Hillary Clinton wins the popular vote, if Donald Trump wins enough electoral votes, he becomes president. That's how he became president, right? So with the Electoral College.
So what exactly is Electoral College? Sorry to cut you off. Just expand for the viewers.
Back to slavery. So So when the Constitution was created, we had the three-fifths compromise. The Constitution, while it's good in terms of what it says, justice and liberty for everybody, it wasn't really intended for everybody initially, because the founding fathers were white men who tended to be property owners, who tended to be educated, who tended to have more money. So they weren't really doing it in, right, and a lot of them were slave owners. So they weren't doing it with the intention of women, of Native Americans who they stole the land from, or from African Americans who most of them tended to be slaves, right? So you get this three-fifths compromise that says, hey, black people are going to be counted as three-fifths of a person, so that in terms of the balance in Congress, the southern states, you know, aren't being dominated by the northern states. Because if you don't count the, you know, with the population, House of Representatives is based on population, right? With the Senate, everybody has two senators. But the House of Representatives, it's all based on population. It's 435 members in the House of Representatives, right? And if this population in the South, if they couldn't count black people to some extent, then they would always, you know, kind of be at the mercy of the North. So they wanted to count black people, but they didn't count them as a full person, because then if you count it as a full person, then the South's going to dominate because they're going to have a larger population, right? So that's the three-fifths compromise, but it also impacted the Electoral College, because what they teach you in high school and in most history classes is that the Electoral College was created solely because they didn't think that the common man had enough knowledge to pick a president, right? And then it was this idea that the U.S. really wasn't just a unified country at the time. So we needed to have these electors who could make the final decision, right? But it was also tied back to slavery, because the number of electoral votes, you know, is dependent on state population. And this is where the number of slaves comes into play for the South, right? So we really don't need the Electoral College. It really should be based upon the popular vote, because if a certain state really has a high number of electoral votes, candidates can focus more of their attention, if they're running for president, on those particular states, right? And if that state tends to vote more Democratic or votes more Republican, then that could really shape the outcome of that election. And that's before we even start talking about voter suppression, which we'll get to a little later. But that could really change things significantly. So if Donald Trump just wins enough electoral votes in the right state, that's enough to get him over the hump. And that comes back to why some people feel like, well, I'm not going to vote because my vote doesn't matter. But like I'm saying, yeah, the system is broken, but you still need to vote, because, again, you create change. And also, you don't, you know, the president, if you've been keeping up with the news lately, when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, the first thing Donald Trump did was say, hey, I'm going to get the replacement, right? Amy Cohen Barrett, I'm going to get the replacement, and I'm going to get her in as fast as I possibly can. So they had her confirmations, just last week in the Senate. And now the Senate's going to vote on it prior to the election. And because the Senate is majority Republican, even if all the Democrats vote no, it doesn't matter, because the Republicans, most of them will vote yes for her. She's going to get put on the Supreme Court, and that's a lifetime job. So what that means is that now if you have a 6-3 Republican conservative majority in the Supreme Court, now things like Roe v. Wade for abortion, things like the Voting Rights Act, if there are cases to come up in court, the conservatives, you know, can strike down a lot of those previous cases and the decisions, which may have benefited women, which may have benefited blacks and other minority groups. And that's important, because that really impacts everybody, right? And that's why the president is important, because now, like, you get Trump out of office, you get somebody else in there who may vote the way you like, they may pick judges. And here's the other thing, too. It's not just the Supreme Court. Trump appoints other federal judges to the bench, right? So whenever you have to go to court, those people, you know, who he's appointed, you know, they're the ones who are making those final decisions. So all of it, you know, from the president down to the courts, to the police, to why, you know, people don't get charged, where you see cops shooting black people and it goes to a grand jury. All of this is tied back. You know, the attorney generals in Kentucky with the Breonna Taylor case. I mean, all of this is really connected, you know, so that's why you got to vote. That's why you have to vote from a practical standpoint. Now, from a historical standpoint, and I hope I don't lose people, because I'm probably going to start nerding out and lecturing just a little bit from a history standpoint. But I do think it's important, right? So, like I was saying, when they had the Constitution, it wasn't meant for us. And when I say us, I'm talking black people, but I really mean minorities in general. Okay, if you're Latinx, if you're Asian, if you're a woman, it wasn't meant for us. It really wasn't, right? So black people can't vote. Women can't vote, right? We had the Civil War in the 1860s between the North and the South. And after the Civil War ends, we know that slavery comes to an end, right? Slavery ends, black people are free. And now there's this question of, well, what are we going to do with all of these free Negroes? And you had a group of people in Congress who call themselves radical Republicans, right? And the radical Republicans were saying, we want to make sure that the new free black person gets enfranchised, that they have equal rights. So they started doing all of these things, passing these different laws during this period called Reconstruction, which lasted for about 12 years, from 1865 to 1877. And during the Reconstruction, that's when you get HBCUs, right? Like Howard and Maryland Eastern Shore, Hampton, et cetera. That's when you get what's called a Freedmen's Bureau. That's when you get a Freedmen's Bank, so that black people can go to the bank, right, and get home loans. That's when you start hearing about a 40 acres and a mule, which we never really got, but that's when you started hearing about that. That's when the amendments get added to the Constitution. So you get the 13th Amendment, and I know a lot of people are like, well, we need to get rid of the 13th Amendment because you could basically enslave somebody by taking away their rights if they go to prison, right? If they go to jail. But prior to that, the 13th Amendment was created to actually end slavery, right? To say that we're going to free all black people. Then you get the 14th Amendment, which guarantees everybody due process and equal protection and citizenship under the Constitution. And then the 15th Amendment. So the 15th Amendment is really important because that's the one that gives black men voting rights. It doesn't give women voting rights because they have to wait until 1920 with the 19th Amendment to get the vote. But black men can start voting. So once that happens, you start seeing black men getting elected to office. They get elected to Congress. They get elected to local positions in their states. And black people are empowered for the first time, right? And it's a good thing, right? I mean, black people actually have power. If the Reconstruction worked, we wouldn't have needed to have a civil rights movement because everything would have been taken care of. But what happened? Say it again.
Like when apartheid ended, the way they made sure everything was equally distributed.
Right, right, right. They had the Reconciliation Committee. Yeah, good job in South Africa. Right, and then they got Nelson Mandela in charge, and he became the president. Black people in South Africa got the vote. Mm-hmm. Right, so everything was good for those 12 years, but like it's the moment things started getting good, then you had people pushing back. Right, so you know we think Republicans now we tend to think it's more like conservative, white people, racist, you know, etc. Right, and we think Democrats are supposed to be the party for minorities. But originally, it wasn't like that. You know, Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. I mentioned the radical Republicans were the ones who were fighting for black people to have equality during the Reconstruction. And the Democrats were the ones who were associated with the South. They were the ones who were associated with slavery and white supremacy. Okay? So when you hear folks like, you know, Kanye say, well, hey, you know, black people used to be Republican. Technically, he's right on that. Like, black people really did used to be Republican. Until you really start getting more into the 1960s and beyond. But, you know, at this point, you know, black people have voting rights, but the Democrats in the South were trying to regain power. And eventually they do, and you get the Ku Klux Klan getting formed, you get the passage of what are called black codes, which are almost like slave codes to start taking away the rights of black people. They use the Klan, they use other forms of terrorist groups to scare black people. So if they tried to vote, they would scare them, they would threaten them, they may kill them. And then they started coming up with things like the literacy test, the poll tax, you know, Jim Crow gets legalized. And then everything changes. So all of those black people who got into office, they eventually lose power. And then once Jim Crow becomes a thing, moving into the late 19th century, early 20th century, now black people are right back to where they were, you know, except they aren't slaves anymore, but they don't have any freedom, right? So this is why you have folks who are trying to vote. And to show you all how serious it was, there was a man named Maceo Snipes. And most people aren't going to be familiar with that story. But Maceo Snipes was a World War II veteran. And when he came back from fighting against Hitler and Mussolini in the war, fought for the U.S., came back. He wanted to vote in an election in Georgia. And when he went to vote, there was a sign that said, the first Negro that votes, that would be the last thing he ever does. And Maceo, I mean, to, you know, use today's language, he was a real one. You know, he's like, bump that. He's like, I just fought Hitler for these mofos. You're not going to tell me if I can't vote or not. So he went and he voted. And then he was first and only black man to vote, right? Went home, was chilling, good for like 48 hours. Some white people knock at his door, say, hey, Maceo, we need to speak to you for a few moments. Maceo's like, sure, what's up? You know, what's good? A firing squad of white men shoots him down and murders him outside of his home. To send a message that, hey, when we say don't vote, we mean you can't vote, okay? So, I mean, that's how serious it was. Like, black people really were intimidated, particularly in the South, against voting, because you could really lose your life if you tried to vote. So once you fast forward to Selma in the 1960s, you know, and when John Lewis died, the congressman John Lewis, who passed this summer, they kept showing Selma, right? And you would see the civil rights pictures in black and white of the young people marching on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Alabama in 1965. They were doing that because they wanted to vote. Because when black people in that community wanted to see change, nobody was there who looked like them, who was in power. So they're like, well, let's vote and let's change things. But when they tried to vote, they might get thrown in jail. They might lose their jobs for voting. Or, you know, the white people in the community would do some real, you know, sneaky stuff, like have the poll open one day out of the month, right? Or they would open up the polling office and it's only open for 3 hours out of the day. Or we're going to open in the morning, and then we're going to take a 3-4 hour lunch break, and then we're going to come back at night. So they made it impossible for anybody to vote. So that was really why they did the Selma campaign, because it's like, we're going to march from Selma to Montgomery, the capital of Alabama, because we want the media to see what we're doing, because that trip takes days to walk that far. We want the media to see what we're doing so we can get people to vote. You know, and then you're going to see, and that leads to the voting rights after 1965. But a year before that in Mississippi, you had what was called Freedom Summer, where college kids, black and white, went to Mississippi to try to get people registered to vote, because nobody in Mississippi could vote. Mississippi was super duper racist. You know, I mean, it was super racist. So these college kids went there for the summer, and on the first day of their program, 3 of the kids got murdered. You know, because they were going, trying to register people to vote, and the cops who were working with the KKK pulled them over on some bogus, hey, your headlights out on your car, so we're going to take you into the jail for a few hours, keep you, and then when they let them out of the jail, they followed them, and they ended up killing the boys, right? You know, and again, that was just because they were trying to get people registered to vote, and the only reason that story got national attention was because 2 of the boys who got killed were white, and they were Jewish, and they were from the North, right? Mm-hmm. Had it just been black people who got killed, they don't get that same type of attention. So the point I'm trying to make is people were literally dying for the Voting Rights Act to get passed in 1965. And once that got passed, not once it got passed, but soon after, you really saw a change. Like 60% of black people were registered to vote in Mississippi just 2 years after that Voting Rights Act, right? In the late 60s and 70s, you have this explosion of black mayors in cities like D.C., Atlanta, Cleveland, Detroit, right? That's, you know, later Chicago in the 80s. And, you know, that's when you start to see the change and black people start becoming empowered in cities, and you have blacks running city councils and local school boards, all of that changed. But, you know, I talked earlier about how most black people are voting Republican, and it shifts, right? So in the 30s, it shifts a little bit with Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression. But in the 60s, more black people became Democrats because of John F. Kennedy and then Lyndon Johnson, who came after him. Lyndon Johnson's the one who signed the Voting Rights Act into law, and he also signed the Civil Rights Act into law. That's when more black people started shifting to the Democrats, right? And then in the 80s, Ronald Reagan gets into the White House, and he's the one who really is pushing, like, heavy conservatism, right? The conservatism we see now, Ronald Reagan was really pushing that, and a lot of black people felt like that wasn't for them. That wasn't looking out for the poor. That wasn't looking out for minorities. So more blacks are registering as Democrats. Jesse Jackson, you know, a lot of folks look at Jesse Jackson now as some old guy, or they don't even know who Jesse Jackson is. But Jesse Jackson, he, you know, was someone who worked with Dr. King, was with King when he got assassinated in the 60s. He became the leading black figure in the early 80s, and he ran for president in 84 and 88. And when he ran, more black people registered to vote, more black people registered to be Democrats. And you saw Bill Clinton appealing to the black people in the 90s, right? And, you know, you saw Al Gore do it, and then you saw Obama do it. So the point I'm trying to make is this is how you see that shift of not just black people becoming Democrats, but also more black people voting, right? But here's the thing, right? And, you know, hopefully this brings it all full circle. In 2013, there was a Supreme Court case called Shelby versus Holder. Shelby County, which is in Alabama, and then Holder's named after Eric Holder, who was President Obama's attorney general, right? So anyway, what happened was Shelby changed up their districts, right? There's this term called gerrymandering, which is kind of hard to explain, but the simplified version is states could change up the voting districts, right? And a lot of times when they do that, you know, in some ways they'll say, well, this is done to help minority communities because we'll put all minorities in one block or one district, and now they have more power to vote their people into office, right? But then gerrymandering can also work against minorities because you could put everybody in one district, so all the power for that whole state for black people or you know, Latinx is just in that one district, but they don't have any say in the rest of the state, right? So that can make it hard, especially if, you know, all the Democrats are voting from that one little area and then all the Republicans are in another area, right? So they changed up the districts to really benefit the Republican candidates, right? And what happened is with the Voting Rights Act, there was a section, it's called Section 5, which says that certain states, right, there were 9 southern states that in order to make any changes to their voting laws or to their voting districts, they had to get approval from the federal government because of their long history of racism, right? But Alabama was saying that, hey, this is 2013. Well, you know, it was a little earlier than that at the time, but they're saying it's not racism. It's not racist anymore, right? You know, we're not like that. We got Nick Saban. We got, you know, Tuma Toa, whatever his name is, at, you know, Alabama, right? We got all the black people playing football and basketball. We love black people, right? You know, it's not racist. It's not racist anymore. So because of that, we don't need to have the federal government overseeing what we're doing, right? So this is how that case became a thing. It goes to the Supreme Court, and the court rules in a really close decision, 5-4, that, yeah, you know, the Voting Rights Act is somewhat outdated, so we're going to strike down this part of the act. But what happened was once that happened, you started seeing a lot of states coming up with voter ID laws now, where if you want to vote, you got to have an ID, right? And it seems simple, like, hey, what's so hard about getting an ID? Well, it's not that simple for people who are poor, people who come from certain communities, people who don't have transportation, right? You started seeing things like, well, you know, if your signature doesn't match you know, when you go to vote, if the signature on your ballot doesn't match the signature on your ID card or doesn't match the signature that we have on file, we're not going to count your vote anymore, right? And that hurts people who might not be as educated. That hurts people who might be immigrants who don't know the, you know, language as well, whose signature may change from time to time, right? You know, they started doing things like purging voters, right? Where some states would say, if you don't vote so often, we're going to send a postcard to you. And if you don't respond to that postcard, then we're going to automatically purge you from the voting file, which makes you ineligible to vote. Some states started closing polling stations, right? So when you watch the news and you see how in Georgia, certain counties, people have to stand in line for 6 hours to vote, right? It's because they closed the stations. It's because we don't have stations. So it's only one station. So everybody's got to go to that one station and they got to stand in line and vote, right? They got to stand in line. And if they can't stand in line one day, then they may leave and they may come back, but they may not come back, right? You know, that's what's called voter suppression, right? And when you hear about Donald Trump saying, well, we got to stop voter fraud. You know, we got to stop absentee balloting, all of these different things. It comes back to this whole notion of voter suppression. And all of these votes, you know, they count. Like, you know, you lose a few voters, that could change things drastically. For example, in 2016, President Trump won the state of Wisconsin by just over 22,000 votes. About 23,000 people weren't able to vote that year because of the change in the law with the voter ID.
Wow.
So imagine if those voters were still voting, would he have won that state? You know what I mean? And that comes back to the idea of the Electoral College, because now that shifts, you know what I mean? That shifts the number of electoral votes he may get, and that shifts the outcome for the presidency, right? So all of this is really, really important. So this is why I'm saying you got to vote, guys. It's so important. And I'm glad when I see people like LeBron James, who's doing the more, I think it's called More Than a Vote, that he set up. It's a website. He's trying to do voter literacy. They're doing voter registration. They're trying to recruit more people to work at the polls. And you know, throughout the NBA bubble, you would see them talking about vote. You would see people wearing it on their T-shirts. You see the NFL. They're doing there's a commercial now with Russell Wilson and Patty Mahomes, you know, doing it. I mean, I think that's so great, seeing the athletes, seeing the entertainers, telling people to get out there and actually vote, because it is so important. And like I said, I'm not going to crucify Colin Kaepernick. I'm not going to crucify anybody who says that my vote doesn't really matter and it's not going to change anything. I mean, if you're not going to vote, then, I mean, that's your decision. If you're doing the work, 9 out of 10, I mean, if you're really out there doing the work, I can't knock you, but at the same time, it doesn't really make a lot of sense for you to do all of that work and then not to vote. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, it's almost like defeating the purpose, because you're doing all of that work and sacrificing all of this stuff, but then you're not voting. And you know what I mean? It's like you're a modern day civil rights leader, but then you're kind of disrespecting the legacy of the civil rights leaders who actually died to make sure that we could vote. And we're focusing on Black people, but that was the case with women. That was the case with the Latinx community, with Asians. You know, I have so many students that I teach who want to vote, but they can't vote because they're DACA students, because their parents are illegal immigrants, you know, and they can't vote. And those kids are scared every day of ICE, you know, coming in and, you know, deporting their family, you know, throwing them in jail, right? You know what I mean? So the fact that if you can vote and you're just not doing it because you don't want to, you know what I mean? Again, I'm not going to... Not gonna put you down, but it's like you really should be out there voting and take your vote seriously. Mm-hmm. Like if you do go out and vote, everybody but Black people and minorities especially, and young people especially, take your vote seriously. Like, again, I mentioned at the start of the conversation, I'm writing a book on Kanye West. Kanye West is running for president. I have a whole chapter talking about Kanye's politics. Kanye, believe it or not, is on at least, I think, 10 ballots. Right. And they just said, the Washington Post just published an article on Friday that said he was just added to the ballot in Maryland as a write-in candidate. OK, but don't vote for Kanye. Like, people, please don't vote for Kanye. Right? And Kanye, you know, maybe y'all bring me back for a future episode and I could really talk about Kanye and like hip hop and stuff. But like, you know, Kanye, you know, he's not studied the issues. You know, he doesn't really have any real concrete policies. He may have some good ideas on some things, but he's not really studied the issues, guys. And like, your vote is so important that, you know, maybe 4 years from now, Kanye is really serious about this and he wants to run again 4 years from now, maybe he'll be a better candidate. But right now, you really just be wasting your vote to go out and vote for Kanye West. Like, don't do that. Like, go out, vote, you know, for Trump or vote for Biden, but also study the other people who are running. When I voted, I actually, you know, I had to study the other candidates because I'm not going to lie, I wasn't familiar with all of them. So I would have to go online. I know the president, but the other people I wasn't that familiar with. So I would have to go online and I would have to look to see who are these people, what's their record, you know, what's their platform, if any, you know, and a lot of that information is online. You know, judges too, you can look them up online. And with these candidates, I know a lot of the public debates have been foolishness this year, but you could look online to see what the actual policy is, what's their record, you know, what have they done. You know, that's important because people lie. People lie a lot at these debates. They get on there and they say stuff that's not true or is half true, or they say, I did this, and you look it up and it's like, they did do that, but then you got to keep reading to page 3 and it's like, yeah, but they did this too. You know, and that's going to be with all candidates, but that's what I'm saying. You really have to do your homework, study these people, study these issues, so you're not just blindly voting because you don't like the other person, or you're voting only because they're a Democrat, or only because they're Republican, or only because this is who your family voted for, or who your friends vote for. You know, study the issues. Don't go off of what you see on Facebook, because a lot of what's on social media is inaccurate. I taught a class on politics and the media last spring. A lot of it's inaccurate. A lot of times people make up lies and they can do it in such a way where it looks true, right? And there's even new technology where they'll post videos and it looks like a candidate is saying something, right? Or it looks like they're, or it may sound like they're saying something, but they have a technology that could allow you to do that. And they'll put it on social media sites and people think it's true. And then that's how they get duped into believing all these different types of conspiracies about various candidates. And now you're hearing things like QAnon and these different fringe websites. And you really, that's why I say, people, just do your homework, but please vote. Black people, like I said, like, please vote. Cause it's so important. And don't get discouraged if at the end of the day, the person you want to win doesn't win. And if at the end of the day, we still see more George Floyds, more Breonna Taylors, Tamir Rice's, Trayvon's, you know, we still have more t-shirts, hashtags, so-and-so, you know, don't get discouraged, because I know we've been fighting this fight for a long time. And I know a lot of Black people are saying, well, I'm sick of fighting this fight. Like, why are we still fighting this fight? You know, it's a slave mentality for us to keep fighting this fight and say it's going to get better, or you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, you really just got to, you can't give up. I mean, you can't give up. And you just can't. I don't believe that violence is the answer. I know sometimes violence helps to get a point across. You know, but like, even if you are going to, you know, be violent, it's got to have a point. Like, you just can't burn stuff down. You just can't just loot. Because at a certain point, it's like, okay, what's the next step? What's the next step? What change are we really trying to make? You know what I mean? So we got to vote. We got to stay together. Everybody's not going to agree with your opinion. Stop calling people Uncle Toms if they disagree with you or you disagree with them. Stop canceling everybody because they have an unpopular opinion. Because that's so whack as Black people. We really got to stop the whole cancel culture. You know, we just got to embrace each other's
conversation.
Yeah. So I've been talking a really long time, guys. Is there any questions or any points y'all want to make before we end?
You answered everything. That, very thorough.
No, I don't have anything, Doc.
Honestly, guys, I mean, just read, man. That's all I can.
Very
just,
insightful.
That's all I can just
and,
keep saying.
Enlighten the audience.
And even
a lot
if you don't like to read,
that they may potentially have questions
it's
for.
There's so many other ways you can learn now, people. Like this podcast, like the one I'm on right now. Podcast, like the one that I'm doing. It's a lot of documentaries. Everybody's got Netflix, I think. Netflix and chill. You know, next time you do Netflix and chill, watch something serious. You know, watch
Netflix and woke.
Yeah, Netflix and be awake for a change. You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, that actually be a good podcast title, but you should copyright that. But like, seriously, like, I mean, there's so many other ways, because I know like some people you don't have time to read, or sometimes the reading could be boring, but you know, it's the podcast, it's the documentaries, it's Audible where they read the book literally to you. Some shows that are like popular shows that you wouldn't even think of. I watch a lot of hip hop morning talk shows, right? And you'll have things like The Breakfast Club. It's a show called Everyday Struggle on Complex, Joe Budden podcast, Sway in the Morning, Hot 97. There's a lot
them,
of those
man.
Shows. They will, you know, they'll touch on some serious topics, and they'll bring on guests who, you know, may be scholars or maybe politicians. And those are the, you know, even people like Killer Mike, you know what I mean? Like, they bring people on these shows who are, like, really doing work in the community, who are really saying stuff, but they're saying it in a way that we can understand it, in a way that is fun. And, you know, watch those shows if that helps you, you know, and... You know, look at what LeBron, you know, is doing with More Than a Vote. You know, get into that. I mean, you know, that stuff is so key, it's so critical. Yeah, so, yeah, please vote, yeah. People. Please vote. That's all I can really say. And be safe. Be safe, too. Wear your mask. Social distance. You know what I mean? Just be smart, because a lot of people aren't being smart out here. They really aren't. And, It's just COVID does still exist, even though some people think it stopped. COVID does still really exist, so just take care of yourself. Thank you guys for having me.
Sounds good, Doc. We appreciate you coming on. Definitely an honor and a privilege to have you on.
No, very thankful to have our first doctor on the podcast. So
yes, sir.
Very
myself,
glad.
You got anything left?
Actually, listen to your podcast and see what you're all about. And I do highly appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, definitely. I'm gonna bring you guys on. I'm gonna have you all come on the show so we could do something. We could chop it up sometime. So we'll make that happen. Okay.
Oh yeah, we got you, Doc. You know we got you. It's our boy Isaiah is not here. He's actually the creator of the podcast.
Okay.
But he's someone you would definitely bond and mesh with pretty well. Mesh with pretty good as well. Yeah. But as they always say, Marcellus, let's close it out. Peace.
Later.